want to talk to you a little bit about the history of Dianetics and Scientology, give you some sort of an inkling as to why and where and so on. And I could give you a long talk right now that would go into a tremendous number of things, go back into the Stone Age, for instance, and talk to you about how psychotherapy was practiced in the trees before it graduated to the caves. Talk to you about the early religious practices, which were themselves a psychotherapy. And talk to you about how psychotherapy dwindled and rose and fell down through the ages, and finally came to 1931. But actually, what I'd like to cover, I'd just like to cover this whole hour's lecture in the next paragraph, and so we can just dispense with it and get on with something important. And that is that in 1931 we didn't have any Scientology, and in 1954 we do. And having covered the history now of psychotherapy in the most egocentric, conceited method I could possibly conceive of, but only to save your time, let's get on to what we really have been doing in these advanced clinical courses. Possibly you'd like to hear something about that. It was a revelation to me on October the 5th, 1953, when the first students enrolled in the advanced clinical course at 726 Market Street, Camden, New Jersey, that in that class, which was composed of some of the best auditors that we had anywhere in America. I hope none of them are listening. We didn't have an auditor. This was a grim fact. These individuals, out of their own ability to handle human beings, by use and adaption of, but mostly adaption of, processes, were processing cases hopefully or hopelessly toward a rather unending goal. Cases got processed and processed and processed and processed and processed some more and processed some more, and people get a little better, you know. They lose chronic somatics, and life would look brighter to them and so forth, but then they get processed some more and processed some more, and then they get just a little better, you know, and life would look better to them, and they get processed some more by these auditors. What was wrong with these auditors? They had been studying at that time Dianetics and Scientology, nearly every person in that first unit. They had been studying this subject for 3 years. You'd say, well, maybe it was case level. Maybe it was too many failures. Maybe it was this, maybe it was that. No, it wasn't. No, it was a very simple thing. So the second unit came in, and I hadn't learned this simple thing yet. And the second unit came in and enrolled, and we worked and slaved over hot brains all day and all night. And when we got ourselves a few minutes to rest, we sweated over some more hot brains. And we studied auditors. We were training auditors, you understand. We had at this time, by this time, because really the first advanced clinical unit was given HC in its most basic elements and theory. And HC was given as a codified procedure. Standard operating procedure HC of Scientology was given a codified form for the second unit. These people then had a technique, didn't they? Why weren't they doing better? And they went on through, and as a matter of fact, we had lots of results, tremendous changes and very spectacular alterations, and uniformly a great betterment in the grade and quality of auditing, always enormously better. But we still really hadn't nailed down that one little factor. Came out here to Phoenix, I think it was, and taught the third advanced clinical unit. And here we had better success and more of it The information was simpler to relay and so forth, and I still hadn't caught on to that single simple fact yet any more than you have right this instant. We moved into the fourth. Maybe the third was in Camden. I get hazy at about this time of day. You know, this is a Latin area, and we have siestas usually here at this time of day. Anyway, went on through the fourth advanced clinical course and slaved on through to the end. More hot brains, better auditors, better results, but still some failures in the unit and still not a level of satisfaction, which was really what we wanted to achieve. And we got on to the end of the fourth, and I still hadn't learned that little simple fact. So we enrolled the fifth. And in 6 weeks, we never missed a night going to bed sadly over this unit. Mostly because we hadn't learned this simple fact yet. So the sixth unit came along, and it drifted through its first 3 weeks of training. And by this time, believe me, everything was codified. Everything was in a slot, you know. There's nothing scrambled much about the subject. But here in the sixth unit were very, very good people. Extremely good people. Right on a par with the first unit. And we worked hard. And along about the middle of the sixth unit, I was struck by the same simple fact, which I hope you were waiting for. That simple fact is auditors can't duplicate. That's all. We'd known that 4 years ago. This gray beard, which you see here, would have no speck of gray in it. The thin shadow, which is now I. Would have more weight. Auditors can't duplicate. What do you mean duplicate? Let's just do the same as, that's all. Can't do it. What's the matter with cases? They can't duplicate. What's the matter with that? Well, when they can't duplicate, they have to do something else. After a while, they run out of new things to do. Then they have to duplicate, and they're unhappy about it. What does this amount to? This is the basic theory of communication. And let me here now give you this theory, if you haven't read it in the PABs and so forth. Communication is a particle or impulse progressing from a source point to a receipt point across a distance. That's a communication. Particle or impulse, from a source point to a receipt point, across a distance. That's a communication. At the source point, we have cause, and that is the definition of cause, the source point of communication, definition of cause. At the receipt point, we have effect, and that is the definition of effect, receipt point of the communication. So we have cause, distance, effect as a communication. Now, a perfect communication would have to have a perfect duplication at the effect point of that thing, particle or impulse, which emanated from the cause point. In other words, whatever came from the source point, if we were going to have a perfect duplication, would have to have at the receipt point a complete, perfect duplication. We would then have a communication. A perfect communication is one which is duplicated perfectly at the effect point, whatever emanated from the cause point. You would find all sorts of trouble with Western Union or Postal Telegraph. Good old Postal Telegraph. I used to send all my things by Postal Telegraph because I hated that only one of Western Union. Anyway, if you had a message and you put it on a Western Union desk in New York City And that message was going to San Francisco, and that message said, I love you, signed Joe. And it arrived with Mabel there in San Francisco, and it said, Mabel, I have eloped Joe. You wouldn't like that. You would say there was something aberrated about the Western Union service. Well, I don't say the Western Union doesn't do this 7 times out of 8. But nevertheless, you are only satisfied with a communication service which will duplicate at its receipt point what is put in it as a source point. Is that right or wrong? Now let's look at a telephone. If you spoke into the speaker of a telephone and you said, sell me 25 shares of Anaconda Mining, and the message which came out of the receiver at the other end was buy 1,000 shares of Anaconda Mining, and you knew it was going down, you'd be unhappy with that telephone. Let me assure you, you wouldn't like that telephone. You might even go so far as to complain. That is all there is to aberration, and that's all there is to unhappiness on the third dynamic. It's all there. And when you've said that, you've just said about everything you can say about the subject. Of course, I'm now going to go on for the next 13 hours and talk. But I've actually said all I'm going to say right there. Duplication. If a man is having a hard time in life, it's because he can't bring about a duplication, and he himself cannot tolerate a duplication. In other words, he himself can't be a cause, and he doesn't dare be the effect of somebody else's cause. Cause we have risen up to be a tremendous God all in itself. God's definition really is cause. And this is about as aberrative as you can get. How long do you think you would actually survive in the state you're in right now if you couldn't be freely an effect? If you couldn't be an effect, for instance, of food, of shade, of water, you certainly wouldn't survive very long. Survival itself, when we get into the field of survival, is utterly dependent upon an individual being able to be an effect. But as he becomes less and less able to be an effect, so he more and more has to struggle to survive. And the struggle to survival is the struggle to be an effect but not to be an effect. And that's what Shakespeare meant, I think. He was one of the earlier advanced clinical course students. When he wrote, to be or not to be, he didn't write the whole thing. You look in the original manuscript there, and it says, to be cause or not to be cause, to be effect or not to be effect, and this is the woe of all man. It's right there in the original manuscript. I just put it there. Oh, you could, too, if you'd have thought. Here we have the big maybe. Am I going to survive? Am I not going to survive? Can I withstand the idea? Can I possibly face the idea of being an effect? Can I possibly face the idea of being a cause? This fellow who goes through life, he can't give anybody orders. He doesn't dare be cause. The girl who goes through life and she doesn't dare hear any of those whistles that are being thrown at her on the highways and byways, she doesn't dare be an effect. And just to that degree, she's having difficulty. The only difficulty really that people can have is with cause and effect. We're into the third dynamic when we talk about cause and effect. And when we talk about a preclear, when we talk about a human being, when we talk about anything, we're talking about cause and effect. We're talking about the third dynamic. All right, if this is the case then, what would a very, very adequate science of mind consist of? Number one, it would not specialize in aberration. That's the first thing. That's for sure. It wouldn't specialize in aberration. We know that. just because people have only gone into mental operation in the past when driven there by the horrors of insanity or something of the sort, is no reason why a science of the mind should concentrate upon misaction of the mind. How could you possibly, though, concentrate on misaction of the mind when nobody knew how the mind was operating? It'd be impossible, wouldn't it? And yet they did it. Very smart fellows. You read back there the Asclepian school of how they induced dreams so as to convince the fellow that he had had a dream, so that he was now convinced that a god had come down to him and said hello, so he was now well. This was a treatment of deranged minds. And, of course, it did nicely for them. It gave the fellow something interesting to think about anyway. And all the concentration on the mind all the way up the track has been in the field of insanity, of neurosis, of aberration, of something wrong with, of psychosomatic ills and all that sort of thing. Why? Well, there just isn't any answer. No race, no species could possibly be this stupid. You know, Joe DiMaggio, when he picks up a ball or a bat, something like that, is operating from the field of the mind. When he hits a home run, you wouldn't think that right away he had acted in an aberrated fashion, would you? You certainly wouldn't. Well, what he's doing is directly and immediately motivated by his mind. And always say, oh, no, it's not his mind, that's his muscles, that's how he was trained. No. No, actually, in the field of sport, a man is as good as he is sane, and no better. Of course, there are a lot of people around that would love to have other people believe untruth. And so they go around saying these big-muscled fellows who go in for sport actually are stupid. They can't think. Well, if they mean by this they can't worry, if they mean by this that they're not sufficiently impressed by the university to study their lessons, if studying lessons and worrying is thinking, well, then maybe these people have a point. But that fellow who can throw a forward pass there for 45 or 50 yards and land it just exactly in that spot, boom, he's sane. He's real sane. You wouldn't find your aberrated person not only you find this aberrated person not only unable to land this pass 45 or 50 yards away in an exact spot, you can't get an aberrated person to spot a spot in space in the room around him. If you don't believe it, try it sometime. As somebody's having an awful hard time with his mind, and he's having an awful hard time with, and so forth. He's been thoroughly trained or something. And, We asked this fellow, all right, now, find a spot in space. Now, spot it. And the fellow says, spot in space. I see a spot in space. It's blue. You say, no. A location in the emptiness of the space out there someplace. Find a location in that emptiness somewhere. It's red now. No, you don't get the idea. We want a location in the empty spot there, just an empty spot in the space itself. And he finally gets the idea. The moment he gets the idea of the thing, you argued him into it. You say, he found the spot. You say, now put your finger on it. You put it here. You say, now put your finger on it again. You put it here. That's right. Now put your finger on it again. You put it over here. It's fantastic. You say, now, wait a minute. Let's just put your finger on the same spot in space about 5 or 6 times. What's the matter with this fellow? What's the matter with him? Very, very interesting thing. He certainly hasn't good enough reaction time. He certainly can't think well enough or calculate fast enough to work in the field of sports. And you'll find this individual very lazy. He ordinarily won't do anything. He won't go out and, sport like walking to the dining room to eat. We discover
two things here. DiMaggio just as soon go out there and hit a home run on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and hit another one on Saturday in each one of the doubleheaders. And then all next week he'd hit two a week if the pitcher wouldn't insist on pitching balls all the time. He'd just as soon hit a home run, time after time. Same ballpark. Exact same location. He'd just keep on doing it. He can duplicate. He doesn't mind communicating either. You go up, it's always a shock to the fans and so forth to find out how easy it is actually to communicate with somebody in the field of sports. You go around and you say, "How are you, Joe?" And he says, "How are you? What's your name?" This is a horrible thing. I mean, the fellow communicated right back. All right. If we have a problem in ability, it is a problem only insofar as an individual is unable to use similar communication lines, is unable to communicate, is unable to spot identical spots in space. In short, unable to do the same thing over and over and over and over and over. And we find a definite coordination between these two things. Get how depraved this society became back in the 19th century when they invented psychology, and many, many years later, about 30, 40 years later, Freudian analysis. Of course, I'm very fond of old Papa Freud. There isn't any doubt about it. He's done a lot for us. No doubt about it whatsoever. He's done a tremendous amount for us. There's datum after datum of Freud's that I am very deeply indebted to. I have a very strong helm, however, and steer around them rather quickly when I see them. But nevertheless, he did point up some enormously interesting things, such as associative reasoning, miscalculations in you mean to say one word and you say another one, and sex is in certain levels of people tremendously emphasized, and that it's very varied. He took the textbooks of Kraft Ebbing, and I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, maybe Kraft Ebbing came after him. I don't know. I never read any Kraft Ebbing. I've run it out a lot of pre-clears, but they never gave me the date. Here we had a tremendous amount of data on sex, and everybody was interested in sex, so on the guess on the theory, you give them what they want, he talked about sex. You find an athlete isn't terribly worried about sex. But when he does get thoughtful on the subject, God help the women. You know, he doesn't sit around reading about it. He performs. Well, that would have blasted Freud's theory to atoms because, amongst other things, all creative artists and all strivings toward championship are totally and completely motivated by our neuroses. If you're not neurotic, don't try to write. You won't be able to write, according to Freud. It isn't that if you're crazy, it helps. That's true. But it helps you get accepted anyway in the Saturday Evening Post today. But it isn't that you're crazy, it helps. He makes the blunt statement all the way along the line, and it's woven into all of our culture now. You go down to the library and every modern book you've got down there, the writer that wrote it got his dialogue, stream of consciousness and motivations, character motivations, so forth, they're out of psychoanalysis. That's the truth. I read a Western story the other day where there was an Oedipus complex discussed. It's really getting there. I expect any time Gene Autry to stop in the middle of the gunfight and prove that the villain is aberrated on the second dynamic. Here we had a school which had just reversed the whole thing. It just turned the whole thing around backwards. It says, the reason man strives is because he's crazy. He's aberrated, so therefore he tries to do something. Therefore, anybody that tries to do something is crazy. I ran into a fellow one time. Oh, he was a very baffling fellow. He was a fellow who had worked very, very hard with boys' clubs in a certain area, and he was quite interested in the future of boys, extremely interested, and he was so engrossed in it that he just practically didn't do anything else. He'd work at his job, and he'd be interested in boys' clubs, you know, and he'd be working all hours of the night, and he'd make speeches and so forth, and a psychiatrist I knew became completely baffled. Obviously, this fellow trying to do good, trying to save humanity, trying to help kids and that sort of thing, obviously he was crazy. See, that was the background and the teaching that the psychiatrist operated on. He was trying to do something. He was trying to get along in the world. He was trying to save people. He was trying to help somebody out. He was trying to do this and that. Therefore, the fellow must be running some sort of a manic. He must be on some sort of a basic, let's be very technical now, louse up. And a psychiatrist went on and talked about this at a dinner party I attended one night. And I listened to him for a long time. I can listen painfully long time if people will keep talking. Normal thing about it is they don't keep talking. You say something in the interim or something like that, and it startles them or something, I guess. Anyway, he went on talking for a long time. And when he got down the line describing the exact Oedipus Electra louse-up, which this fellow had, why, I asked him, I said, well, did you know the man? It's nonsense, he says. Everybody knows that anybody who is motivated, is so manic on the subject, is so concentrated on any one subject, therefore has some basic problem. And in view of the fact that he's interested in boys, he probably has a suppressed problem in homosexuality. It's obvious. I said, wait a minute. You avoided my question. My question is do you know the man? Have you ever met him? Well, no, but that's beside the point. I said, well, we'll arrange it. Called up the fellow the next day, got a hold of the psychiatrist, got him out of bed. It's 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. He hadn't had his sleep out yet. And we went down to call on this chap. And it was very baffling to the psychiatrist, worried him and wearied him no end, to find this fellow back on the back lot with a bunch of kids playing baseball at a furious rate of speed, you know? And the fact of the matter is this fellow could pitch a harder ball and bat a further one than even the older members of these clubs that he was mixed up with and so on, which was his main grip on the subject. You know, the kid's imagination. This fellow could turn handsprings. He could do backflips on bars, on rings. He was quite athletic and so forth. The psychiatrist just looked at all this effort and sort of steadied himself, you know, on the edge of the car. And he said, well, obviously I was wrong. There's really nothing wrong with the man. There isn't any reason, though, now to disturb him, is there? Oh, yes, I said there is. I mean, he talked to the fellow for about a half an hour. This is a very vicious fellow, you know, in total communication. You know, and the psychiatrist looking for the deep significance of it all. I've had a lot of good friends who are psychiatrists. Some people keep pets. And I am not exactly unaware, or really am I hostile to the modern field of psychiatry, if there is a field. But if we, in Scientology, could simply put one new thought into the world, that the mind does have a role in all action, in all construction, in all thinkingness, and that an interest in the mind does not betoken a neurotic, sordid morbidity, and that our data applies to sane minds and incidentally takes in insane and aberrated personalities and psychosomatic ills, we will have put a new standard up there for man. A very worthwhile standard to put up there. Actually, Freud put a standard up all by himself, just one standard, really. He said psychosomatic ills, such things of this character, can actually stem from the mind. That's the one message he really had. He also had another message, which has turned out not to be true, and that is that ills of various kinds, all these various kinds of ills, are remediable through the mind rather than through structure. Now, he didn't go that far, really, to say, you know, not remediable through structure. We can go that far, but we can say something far more important than just this. Unless man understands the function of his mind, of himself, his motives and behaviors, unless he understands this, he might as well go back and hang up his tail on a tree. Because he has now gotten to a point where he can kill more of his fellows per unit weapon than is comfortable in any society which should be considered running. And if he has progressed so far with force without understanding the role of thought in force, then he will just go down and there will be a spreading series of circles on the black surface of yesterday, and that will be all there is to this race. Not particularly, if the race is the last thing in the world to save. You can always make another race. But it's a good playground, Earth. And man has exceeded his license in destruction today. Well exceeded it. If man today could just recognize that an interest in the mind and behavior is not a morbid fixation on neurosis and psychosis, he might himself look at the rest of his fellows instead of being afraid. You can predict the behavior of human beings, but before you can predict their behavior, you have to be able to understand something about their mechanics. And if you don't understand something about their mechanics, you then can't predict their behavior. There is no sense in putting an atom bomb in each pocket just because man is such a mystery, and blowing a whole nation off the face of the earth simply because it seemed like the only thing that could be done at the moment. It just isn't very sensible. Man has come a long way. He has finally bought himself enough leisure so that he can understand something about the mind. Leisure it took, no more, no less. He had to take his mind off hunting and agriculture and business. He had to get enough surplus so that he could look at some of the more luxurious things, you know, such as knowledge. Action, you see, he had to act so instinctively that he could not see that action and thought are actually inseparable where action is concerned. And that is the other part of this. Action and thought. When man first started on the track, he was all thought and no action. Inevitably, he would get tired of being all thought and no action and become thought and action. And then, having gotten tired of thinking about the action, there being so much action by this time, he would become so concentrated on action that he would forget all about thought. And today, if you wanted to state the direction of cure of ills of the mind, you could sum it into one line, that action is senior to thought. A person believes that thought is mired into energy and that energy is superior to thought. And they tell each other every day, what you think doesn't matter, what you think can't hurt me, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names can never hurt me, that sort of thing. Every day they say that, and they say, well, therefore, thought is weak, and energy, action, oh, that's important stuff. and that thought can be easily absorbed by energy and action. That's the basic error. The basic error. Let's look at old Dianetics and discover that the facsimile, that's very interesting energy picture which individuals mock up, that this facsimile would contain in it 55 separate perceptions. And an individual looking at a facsimile could get kicked back by the facsimile. An individual could carry around facsimiles from Lord knows what distant date. They were old, much of these pictures that we picked up. They were very old. They were billions of years old. Trillions. And what were they, however? They were thought trapped in energy. And that's all they were. That's a facsimile. A mental picture, a mental image. All right, if that's the case, then somebody must have thought the thought that energy was superior to thought and could entrap thought. Only if this were the case could an individual who is essentially a thinkingness, not an energiness, could an individual be influenced in his thoughts by the impact of energy. We could take a sentence out of an engram, and the individual would come back into the field of rationality. Here's a little example. Ran into a pilot one time who hated being a pilot, but he was terribly obsessed about flying. He'd go out and he'd get on a United Airlines plane and he'd fly to Pittsburgh, you know, or someplace, and he'd get back in the plane again and he'd fly to someplace else, and he'd get back in the plane, he'd fly back to Pittsburgh, and he'd get in the plane and he'd fly back. He hated this thing. He was going on and on this way. It was the only thing he could do, though. He knew that. He was fitted for nothing else. He was a perfectly bright fellow, quite athletic, easily. His education and so forth could have done anything in the society. But he had to get on this plane to Pittsburgh, you see, and fly it down the front, and get on there and fly back to Pittsburgh. And he was slowly going mad. Well, United Airlines had heard something about Dianetics, so this fellow had been complaining about something, so they sent him around to find out if there's anything to it. We fixed him up, did a little straight wire on the fellow, and the only thing he talked about was this necessity to fly. The phrase that turned up was an interesting phrase, to say the least. I am no earthly good. As far-fetched as it may seem, that was what was basic on this fellow's obsession with flying. He'd run a garage, he'd fail. He'd run something else, and he'd fail. He'd run something else, he'd fail. And finally he took the flying, and he was successful. Because he was no earthly good. All right, well, how can a thought like that get into a mass of energy? Which could then turn around and impress itself upon the thinkingness of the individual, week after week, month after month, year after year, so on, to keep driving him. What was driving his body was the force in that engram. You see, the force in the engram, just boom, boom, shove, 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 the force. And he had the force confused with the thought content of the engram. Well, anybody who was in Dianetics can give you just thousands of such examples. I mean, we just know lots of them. We just on and on and on. Lots of examples. How could a thought get in this energy unless an individual had, first and foremost, assumed that a thought could be trapped in energy? He'd had to have thought this before he could get a thought back out of a piece of energy. It's rather obvious. It's elementary, actually. The basic consideration of thought was that thought could be trapped in energy and you could get it back out again. And this was all a thought. Now, an individual is essentially a thinkingness, which can handle space, can handle energy, can handle objects. But he's a thinkingness that can do these things. And as a thinkingness, he can get so immersed into the energy of handling objects that he conceives the energy to be the final end product of it all. and the thought of no value at all. Sticks and stones may break my bones, things will never hurt me. You just think that's true. Well, go ahead and prove it. Oh, what a misnomer. The thinking that it was true was the truth. Any proof that followed after is represented in energy or matter of any kind, of course, was of nothing. And so we find individuals at large involved in this. They think that thinkingness burns up energy. So we have the boy wonder who was a genius when he was 5, a genius when he was 15, and an old man when he's 21. How could it happen? Well, it can't happen, that's the obvious, unless it is a basic thought to make it so. If he thought this could come true, then it could come true. But at any time along the line, couldn't he have changed his mind about it? Well, no, not if he'd made up his mind entirely that energy was always senior to thought. Why? Because every time he tried to change his mind, he'd sort of edge in on it a little bit and he'd say, well, I think I'll change my mind. Slap! No, thank you. I'm not going to change my mind today. If you don't believe that, get somebody to run a concept sometime and you'll hear and feel the somatics turn on. Get somebody to run a concept sometime. Get somebody that knows he's a very bad student and get this person to run this concept. I am an excellent student. All of a sudden, he feels pressure across his nose or back of his head, something like this. He has to remain in the category of being a bad student because there is something that says so. Something tells him this. And if he tries to unthink this thought, he gets kicked with energy. Oh, but look, how can thinkingness possibly be monitored by energy? Only by supposing it can be, that's all. Let's take Joe DiMaggio, and just as he steps up to the plate, we all of a sudden rush up to him and say, just a minute, Joe. We don't touch him, you see. We just speak to him very quietly. We say, just a minute, Joe. Are you sure? Are you sure you want to go to bed right now? And then walk away. Will he make a home run? Maybe. But a fellow who is less sane, he'd say, I wonder what's wrong. Is there something wrong here? Say, yeah, he'd say, let's see now. Why did he say that? I hadn't seen him before. He said he wanted to know if he was sure it was all right. You don't suppose those gangsters are after me again? Figure. We started a big chain of rationale about it. So he'd go up to the plate and muff it. His ability to monitor energy would have been harmed by his ability being changed in thought. Now, let's get a little more arduous about this. Let's hand Joe DiMaggio a telegram. This has no force in it, this telegram. It's not going to hit him or anything of the sort. We hand him his telegram, and it says, your mother died at 4 o'clock this morning. And he's going to bat in the next minute. You realize that there no force has taken place here. There's nothing which forces him to become a bad batter at that moment, you see. It's his ability to monitor with thinkingness that bat that counts. And that's all that counts in an athlete. Speaking of athletes reminds me of Ensigns. For some reason or other, every once in a while I get back in. I suppose someday when I go to an old soldier's home, sit around chewing the fat with all the old people, we'll be talking about World War II. I suppose even then I will be talking about those ensigns. What they used to do, you see, they used to give you a deluge of ensigns, and you'd train them like mad. They were all the deck officers they'd give you or something like that, and you'd just train them like mad. You'd finally get them to stand in one place and not move from there during the whole watch. You know, not go below or wander back to the galley or something like that. You'd get them so that they would follow out these rules of navigation they had learned, you see, and actually realize that there was something more to navigating than figuring with a pencil and paper, that you really did pick up a sextant, you really did walk up on a bridge, you really did shoot a star, and that had something to do with navigation. And after they'd done that, you very often got one up to the point who wouldn't put you 10 miles south of the South Pole after he figured his site. And after you got him into that beautiful condition, after you got him to a position where he was actually able to stand up there and do a job for you for a few minutes at least, somebody would notice this or suspect that this was happening and instantly transfer him out to a command of his own. If they kept on, the behavior of horse drivers had kept on the way it got to be after the war was over, when they kept running these big battleships in the mud and things like that, I suppose they would have been taking my ensigns to command the Missouri and the rest of the ships like that. But the point was, is we were always fresh out of trained officers, and we were always getting these pink-cheeked little boys out of universities, particularly the University of Iowa, you know. I don't know why, but... These boys aspired to the Navy, but maybe they were far enough away from the sea not to know the worst about it. And they'd come aboard, and then they would be in a completely untrained state, worry everybody for a few weeks or a few months, and then get transferred off just about the time they were going to be some good. This is just what kept happening all during the whole war. There we were trying to put thought into a state of concentration so as to get a certain kind of a job done. We were handling an awful lot of tonnage, you know, we were handling thousands of tons of steel and shells and all that sort of thing. These ensigns were, by and large, chosen because they were fairly strong-looking, you know, and they had good grades, and they were fairly strong, and they'd send them to us. And the kids were indoctrinated into the fact that you exercised all the time, you know. And they'd come aboard with their pull lines, you know, and hook it up to the bulkheads. You'd see them out there early in the morning with these handles going this way. Sometime during the morning watch, you inevitably would see an ensign with runner's trunks on go around the bridge. They get out and box with each other and so forth, and skip rope, do other things. Nothing wrong with this, but they were keeping in shape so as to stay healthy. And they were mountains of health. Magnificent. Just magnificent. The only trouble is 9 o'clock had come along, and if they were standing right there on the bridge, halfway through an action with a submarine, they'd go sound asleep. Boom. you'd leave them in there on the charting table or on the communications bench doing something of the sort. Don't expect them to stay there past 10 o'clock. You'd have to go down and get an old CPO and maybe the cook to come up and stand on the bridge after 10 o'clock because these boys couldn't stay awake. They were trained. All the way along the line, they were perfectly trained. And they were practically stimulus response mechanisms. Our job was simply to get them to change their minds about this, you see, and realize that they could make up their own minds about their own muscles. When they came to us, they were delivered to us, you see, with the coach still controlling their muscles. The coach might as well have walked aboard with them. And 9 o'clock had come along, they could just hear the coach saying, well now, Bus, I guess it's about time you hit the sack, huh? And the kid would go to sleep. this is something else that you can do with thought. Isn't that peculiar? Here, this fellow, obviously, look at all this training he had and so forth. And here he was thousands of miles from home, and he would be in action and everything else. And the coach would say in his ear, Bus, it's about time you went to sleep. I suppose this was a lump of energy the coach sent by teleportation, huh? Well, they were being monitored from afar by some means or another, which was quite mysterious, one of the things which interested me very much in the mind, because here were very healthy young men, and evidently we had to teach them that they could stand on their own 2 feet and do a job of work without direction before they were good officers. And that was the other factor. A fellow's own thinkingness, whether thinkingness about receiving things or thinkingness about sending things or just thinkingness, is the most important to him. Whether it's being used for causation or reception, the most important thinkingness to him is his own thinkingness. And you start introducing somebody else's thinkingness into the handling and control of all of his life, and he is less able. And you have to sort of put him back in his own hands and say to him, say, fella, you know you can think your own thoughts on this subject. Now just look around the bridge here and see if you can figure out what all these things are for. First day he does that, he's just lost. They told him all these names, and there's pictures in a book, but it's just a book. It has nothing to do with a bridge. Had nothing to do with a ship, has nothing to do with a sea. It was what he was taught in indoctrination school, which has nothing to do with anything. I finally got to the point where I used to take their instruction books, put them in the safe. Say, well, you got your choice. You can either go down forward and start mopping decks, or you can hang around the bridge for a few days and learn how to run the ship. Well, who's going to teach us? And I'd give them this big surprise. You are. Almost insurmountable barrier. Take them 2 or 3 days to just get used to the thought that they could teach themselves something. So that after you've taught thought for an awful long time, that is, a lot of thinkingness has taught a lot of thinkingness, that the only thinkingness possible is somewhere else than in the guy's own beingness, the individual has a harder time changing his mind. Why? There's no time in thought. Thought's instantaneous or forever. It doesn't matter. There is no time in thought. Or can there be any time in thought? Well, it's just the fact that he's also made up his mind that he can be worked upon by energy, because time is in energy. Time is the coaction of particles. If time is in energy, then, of course, an individual can watch the energy and tell what time it is. And he's agreed and postulated himself that a certain amount of time passage goes by, and things that happen over a long period of time are harder to change than things that happen over a short period of time. That isn't correct, but they just made up their mind to that. Actually, a mind can make up its mind to anything, and then make up its mind to change or not to change its mind. And out of all of this, we get what? We get the fact that the basic common denominator of all thinkingness is the ability of the mind to consider, to make up its mind about something. Just to consider, to make up its mind, to think something is true. If an individual is well off, he can say and know that it's true. He can think and know that it's true. He can, and that first postulate's gone, and the other one's gone, and something new is true. He is the author of truth, not the agreeer upon truth. And when he slavishly gets to a level where he can only agree with other people's truths, then he's in difficulty. Then he's in difficulty. That is the single barrier in all of the teaching of Scientology. The individual knows this instinctively, that he cannot pick up my thoughts and use them as his own. He knows this. And so I try to make it very amply and adequately clear to him what is true about this. I'm not talking about my thoughts. I'm not talking about my thoughts. I'm talking about that series of considerations which have taken place for the last 76 trillion years in this universe, which have brought it to pass, and to which you've agreed. If you're here, you agreed to them, and to which I agreed too, or I wouldn't be talking to you about them. So whatever I'm talking to you about in Scientology is actually this point. Consideration. Our consideration of. Now, this consideration, of course, has been well codified in Scientology. Probably could be much more ably codified because I did it. But it, an individual getting in there and really doing a scholarly job on it could have done a much better job, I'm sure. Because I wasn't much interested in doing a scholarly job. I just wanted to get an effective job done. And different goals. So, Scientology has been and is a search into that pattern of considerations which comprise this universe to discover the common denominators of all considerations to which all of us in this universe are liable, or else we aren't here. It is a study to find the most elementary of the considerations on which the other considerations depend in order to bring about a situation where consideration itself can be altered by the group or by the individual with ease. If you cannot alter a consideration, you can't have sanity. You have stimulus-response thinking. Unfortunately, if everybody could alter every consideration which he ever had at any time, you wouldn't have a physical universe. As far as we can tell, that comes very close to the truth. Because using these principles, we have gone a long way. But it breaks down to this. The actual fact of Scientology, as much as it would be very nice, a nice feeling on my part to aggrandize my own role in it and so forth, it's actually a job which has been going on for millions of years. Billions of years. Trillions of years. It's a job which has been going on for a long time. Sooner or later, somebody was going to get enough leisure so he could look around and try to find out what he was studying, and then what everybody had agreed upon in order to create what we call reality. Sooner or later, somebody's going to do that. There was an awful lot of data around. There's an awful lot of livingness that had gone on. And sooner or later, somebody himself would be able to buy enough leisure one way or the other in order to do this. I bought enough leisure. I only had to work 3 hours a day, 3 days a week to write 100,000 words a month. The society pays you rather well for 100,000 words a month, public fiction, so I could spend most of my time in research and investigation. That sounds like a fantastic figure, actually. Great many writers that you call classic writers wrote even faster than that, in less time than that. And so myself, writing in fields that were far from classic but were very remunerative, of course was doing no stellar job in turning out this kind of production. But it was in a society and at a time when there was leisure. The only thing that got in the road and the only thing I resent about the whole thing is World War II. 1936, I started telling my friends and writing letters to senators I knew, also pals of mine, that if you don't do something about Japan after Teddy Roosevelt told them that they should establish a Monroe Doctrine of Asia, they're going to be left with only one choice, and that's to commit suicide, and we're it. And they said, what do you mean the Japanese commit suicide? That's nonsense. You mean commit national suicide? They'd never do such a thing. That's their whole cult, individual suicide. Sooner or later, you're going to drive them so far, and they're going to commit suicide. Well, having written a lot of articles on it in Forbes magazines and so forth and so on, I find myself wearing a uniform. I'm still mad. Nevertheless, it took the last year, you might say, of that war when I was in a hospital and spent that whole year studying the endocrine system. So again, the war brought some leisure. I studied for a whole year there, just nothing but the endocrine system and whether or not it was relaying physical commands to the mind or whether or not it was relaying mental commands to the body. You know? I mean, which way did this circuit go? It took me a year and a lot of experiments to find out. And I found out, as far as I was concerned, that function handles structure, and the structure is powerless to alter itself in the absence of function. And having studied that, why, looked that over, why, we were several aces up. We never deserted that role. Function can change thought only if thought considers that it can. And we have said about all there is to say on it. So Scientology, it breaks down, isn't mine. By a long way, it isn't mine. In the first place, studying my own considerations on the track, I wouldn't have come up with these same answers. My own considerations on the track are go off and loaf or have some fun. life is not serious. And it's a lot of fun to string a long bow. My philosophy of existence. It's nowhere evident in Scientology that I've been able to see. Once in a while, I find some part of it in Scientology. It's in these lectures, of course, things like that. And I carefully pick it out and say, too bad, and throw it away. Scientology is essentially a study of your agreements as well as mine. It's a study of what life is doing in this universe. And therefore, you aren't studying my thoughts on the matter. All we do in Scientology is ask you to look at your thoughts and those of your neighbor and friends and see whether or not it's true. And if this is true, then we can do some phenomenal things with it. Well, I have some phenomenal things to... totally experimentally, by the way. I mean, never tried before to try out on you. Scientology is yours, so in the next lecture, I'm going to give it to you. Let's take a break. Thank you.